Okay, so this morning in Meretz Hashem, we are going to begin the seas, the mayim. Or I should say the yamim. It's not really, I'm sorry, that's a typo on top. It should be yamim. We spoke about the mayim actually earlier on. It's interesting, in Perek Shira, as we're going to see, you have a couple of different things that appear to be at first glance repetitive and overlapping, but we'll see. Interesting enough, Perek Shira really looks at different aspects of nature, really is fundamentally different. So we'll see, for example, Mayim was water, but Yamim is going to be the seas. The seas, S-E-A-S. So as we're going to see, each the water and the seas, each of them convey different messages. Let's take a look. Number one, Yamim Omrim. So what do the seas say? Mikolos Mayim Rabim Adirim Mishpereyam Adir Bamarom Hashem. So according to Tehillim, Tzadik Gimel, more than the voices of many waters, than the mighty waves of the sea, Hashem is on high, is mighty. So let's analyze. So remember again, here lies the message of the Yom. So remember, like we've seen, sure, of course. So like we've seen in so much of Perek Shira, nature gleans its messages and ideas ultimately from Tehillim. We've seen a couple of other psukim from various parts of Tanakh, or really Nach, but almost everything from Tehillim. So mikolos mayim rabim, more than the voices of many waters, than the mighty waves of the sea, adir mishper yam adir b'marav Hashem. Hashem is on high, is mighty. So to analyze what the message of the sea is, we'll take a look at two simpler approaches, and then we'll spend a good amount of time focusing on a little bit more of an in-depth approach. So take a look at number two. So this is from a Perush on Tehillim of Rabbeinu Yosef Chiyun. Rabbeinu Yosef Chiyun was one of the Sephardic rabbis in the 17th century who wrote a beautiful Perush on Sefer Tehillim, and he writes as follows. Mikolos Mayram Adir Mishayam Demarom Hashem. So if you skip down a little bit, he says, Vizeh. Skip to the third line, the last word on the line. Vizeh. Vizeh ki aroa mishpereyam v'chazkam be'es neshiva sarach ha'chazakam. So if one sees the strength of the waves, especially again, when the wind is blowing and the waves can become intense and ferocious, yakir mizeh chozek Hashem v'tokfo. So what does this phrase mean? Vizeh ki aroa mishpereyam v'chozek v'chazkam be'es neshiva sarach ha'chazakam. Yakir bizeh chozek Hashem v'tokfo. What does that mean? Excellent. Right? So it says Rav Yehuda is saying something amazing. That from the strength of the waves, one could see the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the truth is, if you've ever been by the ocean on a stormy day, so again, you'll see that the water, the ocean takes on an intensity, a dramatic intensity. Girls, if I could have your attention. If the water takes on a dramatic intensity, right? The waves pick up. And remember again, ocean, as opposed to other bodies of water, also has a current, has a strength to it. So therefore, again, says Rav Yosef Chiyun something amazing. Mikolos mayim rabim adirim mishbereyam. So from the strength of the sea, you could begin to see the incredible strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now this goes back to a basic theme in Perek Shira, which is, why was Perek Shira written? What's the point of Perek Shira? To show Hashem's greatness through nature. Remember again, this goes back to the Rambam's idea. I'm sure we've spoken about this at some point in time. The Rambam explains so beautifully this idea that if one wants to truly come to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how does one do that? Through nature, right? This is the famous idea of the Rambam, that if one goes out into the natural world, one could go ahead and fall in love with HaKadosh Baruch Hu just by seeing nature. Look at the natural world. So the Rambam understands it as one could fall in love with HaKadosh Baruch Hu because one sees the beauty of nature. But the truth is, from what we're discussing over here, one could see the strength of God when one sees nature. You know, I often have this, we're going to see this in Perek Shira also, but, you know, let's say during a thunderstorm. So if you ever look out the window at a thunderstorm, it's always very, very humbling experience. Because man, we make so many technical, logical advances, right? We have the ability to assert superiority over so many different things. And yet what happens? When the thunderstorm comes and the tree collapses and it goes on the power line, you're done, Right? And you can't control that. There's nothing I could do to control the swaying of the trees. There's nothing I could do to control the wind. There's nothing I could do to control the voracity of the rain. These things highlight the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Therefore, says Rav Yosef Chiyun, this is the message. Mikolos mayim rabbi, more than the voices of the many, many waters, adire mishbraya, mighty waves, through the strength of the sea. Through the strength of the sea, I can begin to go out and see the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. By the way, what story in Tanakh do we have that most speaks to this dynamic? Yonah. Right? So Kriyas Yamsuf, absolutely. Right? Kriyas Yamsuf, there was HaKadosh Baruch Hu asserting a mastery over the sea. But by Yonah, remember again the episode where Yonah's on the boat, right? And the Malachim, not angels, but the sailors, right? Mem, Lamed, Ches, Yud, Mem, Sofis. The Malachim, the sailors, realizes something doesn't make sense over here. The sea was so ferocious that they saw this is not normal. And even the sailors, who were pagans, they worshipped many different gods, recognized that this was the hand of God in causing this. So says Rabbi Yosef Chiyun, that sometimes ultimately, again, through the incredible strength of nature, one is able to see the greatness of God. But look how the pasuk ends. Remember, so the seas say, Mikolos mayim rabim, by the way, what does it mean, the voices of the many waters? What does that phrase mean? Mikolos mayim rabim? What do you think that refers to? The sound. It's the sound of the sea, right? It's the sound of the crashing waves. It's the sound that the sea makes when the sea is angry, kiviyachol, right? Adire mishpereyam, the mighty waves of the sea. From that sound, from the intensity of the sea, I begin to see the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But look how it ends. Adir bamarom Hashem. Adir Hashem. Hashem on high is mighty. So Yosef Chiyuna number two, something beautiful. Im hayos yoshi bamarom, gavoa me'adam shal yuchal iroso. V'zeh adas yoshi b'sham, k'li yosem o'alam. So Rav Yosef goes on to say something very beautiful. As not only do you see the strength of God from the sea, that's step number one. From the creation of the sea, from the anger of the sea, from the intensity of the sea, I can see the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but adir bamarom Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even stronger than the sea. So there's a two-part recognition over here. The intensity and the strength of the sea gives me a window of understanding into the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but at the same time I recognize that God is even stronger than the sea. So remember again, this is a two-step cognitive process. I get an insight into the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu from the strength of the sea, but then step number two is, as strong as the sea is, and the ocean can be exceptionally strong, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even stronger. That's the message. So according to Yosef Chiyun, so that would be our first interpretation of the Yom. So the Yom are saying, if you want an insight, sometimes, you know, we speak about how strong HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, how great HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, but the truth is, we don't really understand what that means because we don't really have a full and complete conception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So says the sea, look at me, study me, and you will gain an insight into the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as strong as you think I am, the sea says, no, Adir Bamarom Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even stronger. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even greater. If you look at number three, Rabbi Nachman writes in the Kutei Halacha something very beautiful. Mikolos mayim rabim adir mishpereyam adir bamarom Hashem. Look what he writes. Ki af al pi shamayim rabim adir mishpereyam misgabrim al kol adam. So Rabbi Nachman understands this pasuk in a metaphor. If I were to ask you, if a wave, if you were not to look at the wave literally, but to appreciate the metaphorical meaning of a wave, what's the metaphorical meaning of a wave? What do you think it represents? What do the waves represent? Ups and downs, excellent, good. What else could it represent? What does a wave do? When left unchecked, what does a wave do? It destroys. Right? Chas Hashem, there's an enormous wave. It could take away, could wipe out everything in its way. Shami Nachman understands the waves of life represents the difficulties of existence, the difficulties of the human condition. And the Rebbe says something, he says, Afal pi shamayim rabim adirim, mishpereyam, miskabrim ala adam kolkach, So remember again, so the Rebbe understands Mikolos Mayim Rabim Adirim Mishbereyam. The waves are so strong in life. And the waves represent the challenges, the difficulties, the vicissitudes of existence. And sometimes those waves come on me, and what do I think is going to happen? What do I think is going to happen? You ever get pummeled by a wave? Never happened to anyone here? Right? So in those moments, when you get hit by a wave and thrown under, what goes through your mind?
I just want to see over.
Right, you're tumbling, and if it's really bad, you chas v'shalom think to yourself, I don't know if I'm going to get out of this. Right? And you panic, right? A person panics. So you get pulled under the water, the waves keep coming over you. You panic. So says Rabbi Nachman, life is filled with these waves. These waves of challenges, these waves of difficulties. Now he understands, adirim, they're so great, mishbereyam, I feel like these waves are going to break me. I don't know if I can stand up to all the waves. You know, one wave, five. Two waves, fine. Three, four. But when it's wave after wave after wave, challenge after challenge after challenge, difficulty followed by more difficulty, I feel like I'm going to break. I just don't think that I can actually do this anymore. So it says that I was something amazing. Nevertheless, afa pike nikulam adir bamarom Hashem. How does the phrase end? As strong as the waves of life are, there's something even stronger. What's stronger than the waves of life? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does this mean for us, says the Rebbe? V'hu yigmar ha'kol kirtzano, v'yavi ha'kol el ha'tachlis ha'tov ha'amiti ha'nitzchi. Ki kvar hiktim v'nosan v'yisrael kedushas Shabbos. So the Rebbe says something amazing. Mikolos mayim rabim, adire mishperayam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The waves of life are going to overtake me. The waves of life are going to break me. Sometimes the situations I have to contend with in life are simply too difficult to bear and too overwhelming to manage. And I feel like I'm going to get pulled under and I'm just going to drown in all of this difficulty. What happens in those moments? Our dear Bamaro Hashem. What's our lifeline in life? What's your lifeline in life? Your lifeline in life is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When a person has a strong relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that endows a person with a certain level of tranquility. That endows a person with a certain level of what we'll call life buoyancy. It allows me to float. The waves of life are part and parcel of the human condition. No one escapes the waves. Everyone has waves. What's the only variable from person to person? The only variable in life? Right? Right, the variable is some people, right, you know how the waves come out the ocean. Sometimes it's one after the other, after the other, after the other. Sometimes there's a space in between waves. Those are the variables. So some people are hit by wave after wave after wave. Some people, Baruch Hashem, there's one wave now, another wave in a little bit of time later, but everyone experiences waves. The only variable is the intensity, the nature, and the, we'll call it, I guess, the pace in which the waves come. So how do you survive the waves of life? Adi b'marom Hashem, because there's something stronger than any wave, and that's the Ribono Shel Olam. And therefore, again, when I have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam allows me to get back up after being knocked down by the waves. A relationship with Hashem gives me the strength to keep my head above water, even ultimately, again, when the waves of life threaten to bring me under. This is so incredibly important because sometimes we don't fully appreciate what it means to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We speak about performing mitzvahs, learning Torah, fulfilling the dictates and dictums of the Torah. But at the end of the day, there's a concept of a relationship. And forging a relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam, which is not just, yes, mitzvos are one of the ways in which we perform, in which we create a relationship. But at the end of the day, that relationship is created by so many different things. Most notably, how do you create a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The number one way to create a relationship with God is talk to Him. Talk to Hashem. This is a lost art. You know, we daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but sometimes not davening using someone else's words. Talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chassidus is a concept of his bodidus, being alone with Hashem, and talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, having a conversation with the Ribono Shel Olam, and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, here's what's happening in my life, here's what I'm struggling with, here's what's going great, can you help me with this, thank you for this, you forge relationship. The power of relationship with God is that it keeps you afloat. It keeps your head above water. Without the relationship, you run the risk of drowning. Says Rabbi Nachman, that's the pshat. Mikolos mayim rabim, adirim mishpereyam. The voices of the waters are so intense. The sound of the crashing waves are so intense. They are so mighty. Mishpereyam, I feel like I'm going to be broken by the waters. And in that moment when I feel like I'm going to go under, that I'm going to drown, that I can no longer hold my head above water, I remember, Adir Bamarom Hashem. Kadosh Baruch Hu, I have you. You're my life preserver. You endow me with a level of life buoyancy. You keep my head afloat. Your relationship sustains me, and your relationship allows me to weather any and every storm. Such an incredible idea, says Rabbi Nachman, about what it means to have a relationship with Hashem. At different times in life, we are in danger of being sucked underneath. And a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows me to keep my head above water. Now, I want to point out to you, our relationship with God doesn't save you from what? From the waves. This is very important. A relationship with Hashem does not. The waves are part and parcel of life. That's it. Everyone has to deal with waves. This is sometimes a misconception that people have, that life should be filled with tranquil waters, smooth sailing, no waves. It's not true. Everyone has waves. Now, the truth is, the size of the waves could depend on the person. Some people deal with smaller waves. Other people deal with daily tidal waves. Everybody deals with waves of some sort. No one's waters are serene, placid, and calm. Everyone deals with waves. But a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is what allows you ultimately to deal with the waves in life. To take this a little bit further, if you take a look. So that's, and I have so far, two approaches. Right, approach number one, Rav Yosef Chiyun, that message of Yom, the message of the seas, right, of the Yomim, ultimately are that I could learn of the greatness of God through the seas, and not only that, as great as the seas are, as mighty as they are, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is even mightier. Rabbi Nachman, the seas teach us that as much as sometimes you think that you are going to get pummeled by the waves of life, and we all get pummeled by the waves of life, Adir Bamarom Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is my life preserver, and a relationship with Him allows me to keep my head above water despite all of the waves. Take a look at number five. There's an amazing Gemara. The Gemara Baba Basra says as follows: Mishalo Ra Binyan Hordus Lo Ra Binyan Noat Miyamav. So at least we're going to begin this last piece, because I think this is incredibly amazing. So the Gemara says, whoever did not see the Binyan... Now, what does Binyan Hordus refer to? What's Binyan Hordus? Second Masechta. So remember again, let's a little bit of history. So we know again, there was second... So remember, second Beis HaMikdash was rededicated by who? Hanukkah. Familiar with it? 8 days. Menorah. Right? The Chashmonaim. Right, the Chashmonaim were the ones who rededicated the second Beis HaMikdash. Right, they came in. Remember, you're familiar with the story. A little bit of oil, last 8 days. Okay, excellent, good. Right, so remember, they come in, they rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Chashmonaim did something very interesting. Chashmonaim were from what Shevet? Levi. Right, they were Levim. Well, they were Kohanim. Right, they're from Shevet Levi. Now, the Chashmonaim did something very interesting, which is, after they rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, not only did they operate in the function of Kohanim, but they also assumed the monarchy. Let's assume the monarchy. So I'll ask you. Well, now remember, monarchy normally comes from which Shevet? Yehuda. So was it a good thing or a bad thing that the Chashmonaim took on the monarchy? Okay. The answer is it's a machlokes. It was a dispute actually between the Ramban and the Rambam. The Ramban understood it was a major mistake. They overstepped. The whole idea in the makeup of Klal Yisrael is that different shvatim have different responsibilities. That's the way it works. So therefore, again, religious leadership is to come from Shevet Levi, and what we'll call political/military leadership comes from Shevet Yehuda. And there's a reason for that. Now, I'll ask you this. Does Judaism believe in separation between church and state? You understand what I mean when I use the word church? No, right? We do not believe in that, right? We have no separation between religion and the running of the country. There's no such thing as a government that is independent of religion. This is exceptionally important, right? Remember, the same is actually, I just mentioned this in my last shiur, that we don't, does Judaism believe in democracy? No, we do not believe in democracy, right? We do not believe in a system of government where everyone has a say, where everyone has a vote. Remember again, what's the system of government that the Jewish people have? Oh, excellent. A theocracy. Excellent. A theocracy, which is a monarchy governed by religious values. Right? So remember again, we have a king that comes from Shevet Yehuda. Right? The king is appointed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Alright? In the absence of Nevuah, could be the Sanhedrin, the Navi. Right? So ultimately, we have a king. That king doesn't get to make his own laws. That king must execute the dictates of the Torah. The kingdom of Klal Yisrael is run based on the tenets of the Torah. But interestingly enough, there is a separation between religious leadership, right, Shevet Levi, and what we'll call political military leadership, which is Shevet Yehuda. Now again, to be clear, it doesn't mean that Shevet Yehuda, monarchy, is separate from religious values. Religious values guide anything and everything. B'nai HaKadosh Baruch Hu felt that there should be people dedicated to religious leadership, and there should be people dedicated to political / military leadership. So the model was set up. Yehuda is monarchy, Levi is religious leadership. So the Ramban says, therefore, the Chashmonai made a critical error. They should not have assumed the monarchy for themselves. That was an overreach. That was an overreach. The Rambam says, no, it's absolutely the right thing to do. Why was it the right thing to do? Why do you think it might have been the right thing to do? We understand why it's wrong. Because it's wrong, because that monarchy has to come from Yehuda. Why would it be right? Because, excellent. Because the Rambam says, essentially, there was such chaos. There was such chaos. There was such an existential danger to Klal Yisrael. Remember again, we even know from the Hanukkah story, right? You know how the Gemara reads that, remember, they found the Pach Shemen with enough oil to remain lit for one day. It remained lit for 8 days. The Gemara then says, L'shana Acheres, in a subsequent year, they established Hanukkah as a Yom Tov. What's your obvious question on that Gemara? Why not that year? Notice, after you see that the little bit of oil burns for 8 days, so why not burn it? Why not declare it as Yom Tov right then and there? What's the answer? So it could be they had to see if the Koach was going to come back the following year. Excellent. There's a simpler answer. The Sfasemes says there was such rampant assimilation, that to declare a new Yom Tov for Klal Yisrael looked like a joke. They had to rebuild the ranks of the Jewish people before you go ahead and you start declaring new Yomim Tovim. Therefore, says the Rambam, there was such an existential threat to Klal Yisrael that the Chashmonaim felt they had to stabilize the ship. Right? The ship was sinking, they had to stabilize things, and therefore, again, they went ahead and they took the reins of monarchy together with the reins of Kahuna. So Ramban says they made a disastrous mistake. Rambam, they did absolutely what was necessary for the times. So remember again, this begins what we call the Hasmonean dynasty. Right? There were a couple of Chashmonai kings that came about. How did the Hasmonean dynasty, how would you rank their success? Right? Middle to low. Not very good. Unfortunately, again, the Hasmonean dynasty did not work out very well. For a variety of different reasons, there were a couple of good kings, but it just did not work out well, to the point that you pretty much saw like a disintegration of the monarchy. And unfortunately, remember again, during the Second Temple era and the Second Temple era, you also find a disintegration of the kahuna. Remember, there was a certain point in time where the kahuna gedola was sold to the highest bidder. So you find ultimately a disintegration of kahuna, a disintegration of malchus. Now, one of the very interesting stories in the Hasmonean monarchy was as follows. The Chashmonaim had a slave by the name of Herod, Hordus. Right? And the Gemara relates that one day Hordus heard a baskal. Hordus heard a baskal. Now, the backstory to this is Hordus, right, who was a non-Jewish slave owned by the Chashmonaim, fell in love with one of the Chashmonai daughters. Now, of course, she would have nothing to do with him. He was a non-Jew and he was a slave. So the Gemara tells the story that one day Hordus hears a baskal, right? The voice from heaven that says, on this day, any slave who rebels against his master will be successful. Hordus takes this as a sign from above. He leads a slave rebellion. He rises up against the Chashmonaim. He kills out the entire Hasmonean family. The entire Chashmonaim family, except one person, guess who? The girl who he fell in love with. She goes up to the rooftop. She cries out. She says, I am the last remaining member of the Chashmonai family, Anyone who claims to be of the Chashmonai family after me is really a slave, and she throws herself off the roof. She kills herself. She'll have nothing to do with this slave. Herod essentially kills out the entire Chashmonai family. Herod becomes king. King Herod. Was Herod good or bad for the Jews? It really depends on the day. The truth is, if they're probably doing like a psychological profile on Hordus and Herod, he was probably schizophrenic. Meaning, he was probably schizophrenic because what we see from Herod is polar opposite behaviors. On one hand, Herod wiped out almost the entire Sanhedrin. Why does he wipe out the entire Sanhedrin? Because he felt that they were a threat to his rule. He knew that he would not... Remember, Herod positioned himself as a Jewish king. Right? That's what he claimed. He wasn't, I'm a Jewish king. The only problem was, he wasn't Jewish. A little detail. Right? And also, he wasn't fit for monarchy. Monarchy comes again. Even if you want to say that the Chashmonai made an exception, there's Shevet Levi. It's Levi, it's Yehuda, it's not Herod. That's for sure. So Herod wipes out almost the entire Sanhedrin. After he wipes out the Sanhedrin, he felt bad. He felt really bad. Understandably so. So what does he decide to do? He decides to make a major overhaul of the second Beis HaMikdash. So for this, we owe Herod an incredible debt of gratitude. Because remember again, what did Herod do? Now, the most dramatic thing that Herod did was to the Har HaBayis. So the Har HaBayis, as it looks today, that's what Herod created. So understand, now, if you've ever been to the Kosel, to the Old City, or if you've ever gone up on the Har HaBayis, you'll notice that it's very strange, because generally, the Beis HaMikdash was built where? What mountain? Right, it's not Har HaBayis, because Har HaBayis is the name that's given to because the Beis HaMikdash was built on. What mountain was it built on? Har HaMoriah. Har HaMoriah is a mountain, right? If you ever visit the old city area, what seems to be missing from the topography? A mountain. Why is that? Because Herod did something fascinating. Herod went ahead and filled in the entire site to make it large and flat. So what he did was, he built what's called retaining walls. So if you can imagine, you have Har HaMoriah in the middle. So imagine a mountain in the middle. You build retaining walls, which are large, tall walls all around the mountain. What do you then do? You fill up those areas with dirt, and you create a large plaza, a large flat area. So the Har HaBayis as we have it today is the expanded Har HaBayis as built by Herod, which is by the Kosel. The last piece of remaining wall is not a wall of the Beis HaMikdash. Right, that's not all the Beis HaMikdash. That is one of the retaining walls that Herod built. So if you can imagine, again, that's it. You see that wall is massive. And remember, again, if you go into the tunnels by the coast, you'll notice those walls extend way down. Those are retaining walls. So those were huge walls built to create a flat plaza, which is, if you think about it, an incredible debt of Hakaras HaTov that we have to have towards Herod. Why? Because the fact that we have any peace of the Beis HaMikdash anymore is a piece of what Herod built. Any part of the original Second Temple structure was gone. What we have today is the leftover from Herod, which is why also, just actually a fascinating idea, are you allowed to go out to Har HaBayis today? So it's a machlokes, and the truth is, I will tell you something very important, which is virtually everyone agrees that there are definitely parts of the Har HaBayis that do not contain Kedushas Beis HaMikdash, right? The issue of going up onto Har HaBayis is entering into a place that has Kedushas Mikdash, temple sanctity, but yet we're all ritually impure, we're all Tamei Mason. There's no question in Halacha that there are many parts of what the contemporary Temple Mount, what we call Temple Mount, that do not have Kedushas Har HaBayis or Kedushas Beis HaMikdash. Why not? Because in order to endow an area with Kedushas Beis HaMikdash, the expansion must be done with the agreement of the Sanhedrin. Did Herod go ahead and expand the Beis HaMikdash or the Temple Mount with the agreement of the Sanhedrin? No, why not? Because he killed most of them. So it's just an interesting historical aside. But nevertheless, again, so what you see today, right, if you see pictures of the Har HaBayis, so again, you see a large flat plaza, right? The topography of the Har HaBayis and the Temple Mount is, it's a large flat area. You might have thought to yourself, how could it be flat if the Beis HaMikdash is built on a mountain? That's all because of Herod. All because of Herod. So if you take a look at number 5, so the Gemara says something amazing. Not only did Herod go ahead and build the Beis HaMikdash, or fill him the Temple Mount, the Gemara says, Misha lo ra'a binyan hordos, lo ra'a binyan no'e miyamov. Whoever did not see the building of Herod, right? Now we're going to see what Herod did is, he also went ahead, he did a number of things. He expanded the Temple Mount, and he also tried to beautify the Beis HaMikdash itself. So the Gemara says, whoever did not have the privilege to see Binyan Hordos never saw a beautiful building. B'mai B'nayo, what did they build? So remember, this was under Herod. How did they beautify the Beis HaMikdash? Amar Abba, Ba'avne Shisha Umirma. They used beautiful stones of white and green marble. So you have to imagine this. The exterior of the Beis HaMikdash was made with blue and white, excuse me, green and white marble. Others say it was blue, white, and green marble. Apik safa, the aisle safa. Now the way, so essentially if you could imagine, they had large marble stones. Like if you could imagine like bricks of marble bricks, but larger than bricks, stones. Right? So blue, green, white, whatever it was. Now the way they built it, there's a term for this in architecture, I don't remember it offhand, but essentially one row jutted out, and one row was recessed in. And this is how the structure was. One row jutted out, one row recessed in. So the Gemara says, Kihechi dine kabel sida. Now ostensibly they did this for structural purposes, which we'll discuss. Savar l'shamei l'mash'ei bedava. So Herod, again in a moment of remorse, wanted to make good by the Jews. He said, you know what? Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to cover the entire exterior of the Beis HaMikdash in gold. Can you imagine this? Entire Beis HaMikdash exterior walls, which were huge, entire exterior area coated with gold. Amar le Rabbanan Shafke. The rabbi said, no, thank you. We don't want the exterior of the Beis HaMikdash covered in gold. Why? Dehachir Shapir Tfei. We like this better. Demichsi ki idvisa demaya. Because right now, when you look at the Beis HaMikdash, what does it look like? It looks like the waves of the sea. So if you could imagine this for just a moment, how beautiful this must have been. Green, blue, and white marble. One row jutting out, one row jutting in. So if you look at it from a distance, what does it look like? It looks like the ocean. It looks like the waves of the ocean. So the Rabbanim saying to Herod, thank you so much for the offer to cover the entire Beis HaMikdash in gold. We're not interested. We want the Beis HaMikdash to remain looking like the beautiful and flowing waves of the ocean. We're going to stop over here for today. We'll pick up in Yeretz Hashem on Monday with why Chazal wanted the Beis HaMikdash to look like the ocean and the deeper symbolism in it.